Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good afternoon. Welcome to all of those of you in the room, and welcome as well to those joining us online. I'm Professor Jonathan Birch. I'm Director of the Jeremy Collar Centre for Animal Sentience here at the LSE. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to this event on food futures. It's the last day of the LSE Festival on the theme of how to save the planet. It's also the first day of London Climate Action Week. And so I'm really pleased to be here with the panel talking about a topic that I see is absolutely central to both of those events. I don't see how we can save the world. I don't see how we can successfully halt climate change without some changes to our food system. And so it's a pleasure to be joined by a panel who in different ways are researching possible visions of the future of our food system, and in some cases are also actively trying to turn those visions into reality. They are Chris Bryant from Bryant Research. This is a think tank which uses social science to help alternative protein companies advance the protein transition. Feiyang Wang, research officer in psychology at my center, the Jeremy Collar Center for Animal Sentience here at the LSE. Tara Garnett from the University of Oxford, director of Table. Table explores visions for the future of food and provides a platform for interdisciplinary knowledge and dialogue. And Anthony Warner, a chef and an author, author of many books, including perhaps most relevantly to this event, Ending Hunger, The Quest to Feed the World Without Destroying It. So Tara, let's go to you first. We're thinking about the future of food. One question people might have if they're new to this topic is, why is there a problem? What is wrong with the status quo? What is it that needs to change?
Okay, well, thanks for the introduction. Hello, everyone. So again, it's really difficult to know in the audience who I'm speaking to and what level of knowledge you all have. So I'm going to start with some quite ABC stuff about the food system, just to provide a bit of scene setting. So first of all, some terms. The word food system is probably going to crop up a lot. The food system refers to the set of actors, activities, and institutions involved in the producing, distributing, selling, and consumption of food, and all the consequences thereof. So that's kind of to set the scene. So we're talking agriculture, harvesting, food processing, retailing, all the rest of it. And if you look at the system at a global level, it has very, very profound environmental and social consequences. At one level, it's been really, really successful that more people now are fed adequately than at any other point in human history. And yet there are these massive problems. The food system's accounts for about 25 to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It's the main user of land on this planet, and land for food is more or less land not available for other wild things. It's the major driver of deforestation and land degradation, and it's the main cause of unsustainable water extraction and also huge problems of water pollution. And then when it comes to the problems of actually the consequences of the food that we eat, although, as I said, more people get adequate calories, we are tipping from the problems of insufficiency into the problems associated with excess. So we have all the non-communicable diseases associated with and also independent of obesity, like heart disease, stroke, some cancers. And then the other really interesting and scary thing about the food system is that it exacerbates and exemplifies inequalities at every single stage, from insecurity and inequality of land tenure through to unequal, sort of insecure and hazarded employment, through to the fact that poor people eat worse around the world and suffer the consequences of poor diets. So that's kind of the problem. So it's quite well recognised now. So when it comes to solutions, I guess the question is, how do people think about, you know, we know what the problems are, but what are the real causes of the problems? And you talk to different people and you get different problem diagnoses. For some people, it's all about insufficient technological innovation. Like, look how much progress we've made. Yes, we've got problems, but we're very ingenious. What we should be doing is ramping up and improving the innovation, the efficiency of production, the efficiency of distribution, things like novel proteins and all the rest of it, to deliver us what we want at lesser environmental and social cost. Another problem diagnosis is actually it's not about technology, it's about human greed, human demand, and what we need to be doing is reorientating our consumption patterns to fit the boundaries of planetary sustainability. And then a third diagnosis is that it's not about more, it's not about less, it's not even about innovation, it's about inequality. And if we have this systemic inequalities in the food system, that's what we need to be focusing on. So when it comes to what the solutions are, and I've been asked to come up with some kind of solutions, first of all, be very, very suspicious of anyone offering you solutions, because the thing about food, as I've tried to show, is that it is fantastically complex. And a very good example of that is the fact that funding for work on the food system is really, really inadequate. And the reason is that everyone wants nice, clean, easy solutions, and working on food isn't going to give you that. You've got lots of different greenhouse gases whizzing around, you've got lots of different environmental problems, you've got the social problems thrown into the mix. So I would say if there's one or two things that I would recommend is, first, understand and embrace that complexity, recognising trade-offs. And then the second thing I would offer up as a solution is to try and think in that systems way. So try and coordinate, try and join up among actors who are working on different problems in different ways. It's not that people shouldn't work on their specialisms, but they should also be talking to one another to understand how what they do fits into the sorts of things that other people are doing, so that we don't end up with unintended consequences.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tara. Wonderful summary of the terrible problems. I just add to what you're saying, also our current food system is a disaster for the animals themselves in many cases, particularly the intensive conditions in which chickens and pigs are being currently reared in and the welfare problems to which that gives rise. You've said, I mean, be skeptical of anyone offering solutions. That is what you're working towards, though, isn't it? I mean, through these interdisciplinary conversations, you must have some optimism.
You're asking for optimism asking as well as solutions.
mean, okay, be suspicious of anyone offering solutions or optimism.
Okay,
but so what gives you hope? What gives you grounds for hope?
Well, I suppose what gives me hope is the fact that there is a lot of people are working on this, that I think there is a great deal of understanding as to what the problems are that we face, and that there are more and more people entering this space trying to understand and work on the very, very many different aspects of the food system, from kind of financing the transition through to alternatives to meat, through to some of the more kind of sort of regulatory and legal aspects of the transformation. So it does give me hope that there are people working on it. And I think if you know, we have seen some shifts in things like food availability, the sorts of availability of food that is kind of on offer in places like London. But it's still really patchy and really, really slow. So yeah. I wouldn't say I feel very cheerful, no.
Fair enough, yeah.
Sorry.
Chris, I think it'd be great to bring you in on this because, I mean, we're thinking about solutions, your work on alternative proteins, you must at some level see that as part of the solution.
Certainly, yes. I think a lot of the problems that Tara's highlighted are to do with animal products and animal production and consumption. We massively overconsume and overproduce animal products in general, particularly through intensive systems, which make up the majority of animal farming, and which, on reflection, anyone would say is a disaster from a moral perspective. It seems to me like every day is a disaster, really, given kind of what's going on to get the food on top
optimism.
Of
plates
currently.
Optimism.
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Well, that said, I do have some optimism to share with you. I think there's kind of two levels of this, two ways of thinking about this. One, on an institutional level, what are governments and companies and the institutions that make up our societies doing and changing, and how can they move in the right direction? And then also on the individual level, what can we all do as regular people who are engaged in the system and have to eat something? Now, I am very much into effective altruism. I don't know if anyone here is familiar with effective altruism. It's big, it's very fashionable, effective altruism circles looking at food systems to be very much focused on institutions, government policy change, corporate policy change, and so on. I think one thing that is sometimes missed in that analysis is that institutions are ultimately made up of and beholden to individuals. So governments, for example, can't just ban factory farming tomorrow if all of the voters want cheap animal products, because they'll just vote for the other side, right? Likewise, a supermarket chain can't just say we're not going to sell factory farm products anymore if all of the consumers want cheap animal products, because they'll just go to the other supermarket, right? So there are some limits and kind of windows on what institutions can do that are set by individuals, and I think ultimately the culture, the social, you know, what we all think and behave and towards the food system sets that and dictates that. So on the individual level, I think it's useful to think about push and pull factors when we're talking about individuals choosing to move away from animal production towards alternatives. In this analogy, the push and the pull are both going in the same direction. So you can think about push factors as being putting the reasons to reduce consumption of animal products in front of people. This might include showing people images from factory farms and from slaughterhouses. And in fact, the evidence that I've seen tends to suggest that that tends to be actually the most compelling way of doing this, although a lot of people seem to have the idea that that's not the case and it will cause dissonance and so on. I think that's only half the story. So I think you need compelling push factors. That moral message and centering the animal, I think, is an effective way of doing that. There are also, of course, environmental and health arguments that different people might find to be compelling as well. And alongside those push factors, a great example of this, by the way, has anybody seen the Project Slingshot ads on the tube, where they have the pigs in gas chambers and now they have the chicken one going on? These are like compelling push factors that are designed to wake people up and think, okay, maybe I need to move away from consuming animal products. And I think complementary to that are the pull factors, which are alternative proteins getting better and getting cheaper, such that there's less of a cost to the individual of moving away from animal products, because now you have pretty good alternatives that you can go to. Plant-based meat is healthier than meat from animals. It's also now increasingly cheaper, which I think is going to be a game changer. There's been, I think now, five different analyses in the last 3 years, I'll say, ish, that have showed plant-based products getting cheaper than analogous animal products for the first time in the UK, in Germany, and the Netherlands in particular. And I think that's game-changing. This really has not been the case. Animal product alternatives have generally tended to carry a price premium, sometimes quite significantly. And now, for the first time in literally the last few years, now you're seeing alternative proteins are significantly cheaper in some cases than animal products. There's a recent analysis showing plant-based burgers and mince and meatballs, I think it was, are 33% cheaper than beef mince and meatballs. So we're talking about significant price savings on the alternative proteins, and I think that is really going to be a game changer. And I don't think we've seen most of the effect of that yet, because as I say, it's a very, very recent thing. Incidentally, in the year where that has switched, Tesco announced that plant-based mince saw 25% year-on-year increase in sales. That's after several years of mild decline, actually. We're not talking about like the hype years of 2019. It's back in significant growth now, and I think that's definitely to do with the price getting cheaper than animal products now. So put a bow on that. You've got the push factors, which I think Project Slingshot is doing a lot of things right in terms of their messaging, compelling reasons, emotive reasons for people to move away from animal products. And then complementary to that, you've got the pull factors, which are the alternative proteins. And again, I'm very optimistic there, mainly because of the changes in relative price.
It'd be great to bring in Feiyang on this, because Feiyang, you've got this interest in perhaps one of the most controversial alternative protein products there is, actually, which is the cultivated meat grown from like animal cells. Try talking into the table, Mike.
Okay. This is fine. Okay.
slightly improvised AV setup.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
So for the past half year, I've been doing research on like the cultivated meat industry and also the consumer acceptance side of that. The industry perception is actually not always consistent with the consumer responses. But I actually agree with Tara about a lot of times the inequality is the main driver of a lot of those issues, because when we think about like novel food technologies like cultivated meat, a lot of the evaluation of it and also the development of them has been done in the Western context. And based on the life cycle analysis I've read, cultivated meat is actually very electricity intensive industry. So if they use renewable energy, it's likely to produce positive environmental impact. But if you try to apply that to like the global source, which they kind of are trying to do, but if you directly do that, it may not have the same sustainability impact as they want, because the renewable energy is not accessible there. So that's from the production side. It's always good to have more localized, more like region-specific, culture-specific research done. Back to the solution question, there won't be an overall solution for like each part of the world. We always need to more research like for each specific region and society. And that's also for the consumer research side. So for the research we have been doing on the UK consumers, so a lot of the marketing companies working for like the cultivated meat industry has been using the data from on the US consumers, and they have these results and believe that the animal welfare related messaging would not land well with the consumer, and the consumer would be more willing to pay for the health benefits. And they kind of take that as like a general, overgeneralize that opinion and sell that to all the alternative protein industry. But actually in our experiment on the UK consumers, it's also in one of Chris' research that like UK consumers are less responsive to the health messaging overall than the US consumer. And when we compare the animal welfare messaging with the health-related messaging, we find that UK pet owners are actually more responsive to the animal welfare messaging. Of course, because their past experience of interacting with animals, also, I don't know, maybe also because of the UK tradition, identity as animal lovers. So a lot of times we would think UK and US culture are very similar. Like when we do culture studies, we kind of pair you guys together. But even for UK and US, there are like significant difference in what type of messaging would work better for each country. So that just highlights the importance of doing more localized research, no matter on the production and the consumption side of the food system transformation.
But it's not just that we face trade-offs, but also the nature of the trade-offs varies locally from one country to the next around the world. So Anthony, you must have a really distinctive perspective on these issues, having worked as a chef for decades. It must give you a...
Not too many decades.
Before becoming an author, I mean, you must think a lot about, how cultures vary in their food preferences and how difficult it is sometimes, despite all the optimism we had from Chris there, how difficult it is sometimes to get people to change the way they eat.
Definitely. I can talk a little bit about that. I can also talk a little bit about some optimism as well, because you asked for that. I completely agree with the sort of insight that there are huge problems in our food system, and they affect so many different environmental factors and health factors that it is one of the most significant issues that needs addressing in the world in terms of environmental impact and health impact. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But what I do find extraordinary is the fact that, and I'm incredibly optimistic about, is the fact that we do know how to feed sustainably a population of roughly 11 billion people, and the population will probably rise to 11 billion in 2070 or so, and then start to sort of tail off on four, won't get much beyond that. So we can sustainably feed humanity forever, which is, I think, would be the most remarkable achievement of humanity. I think it would be the most remarkable scientific achievement and a remarkable social achievement to be able to defeat hunger, which has been this enemy that mankind has faced throughout the entire span of our history. So we can do that. And the fact that we know how to do that, I think, is absolutely extraordinary and grounds for huge optimism. Obviously, we're not doing that. We are heading for significant and horrific environmental impacts, which you know, sort of almost too numerous to detail in huge detail here. And we do need to have this enormous transition. We need to eat far more plant protein and far less animal protein, and that's a difficult thing to do. I think we kind of know how to do it, though, because you just need to make the healthiest and most sustainable options. We need to make them the most delicious, the most desirable, the most available, and the most cost-effective. And if we can do that, then I can almost guarantee we will have significant change, which is why, you know, as a chef, I believe that making the most healthiest, most sustainable foods, the most delicious, is the most important thing I can do with my career, and I do lots of work in that sort of area. I probably don't agree entirely that sort of messaging about, you know, making people feel perhaps ashamed or scared of the food that they currently eat as being the best way of encouraging change. I never see that as a positive thing to do with food. I don't think sort of that sort of messaging around food is really useful. I would rather just say, let's make the healthiest, most sustainable options the most delicious and the most desirable. And that's how you'll get significant change. And it, you know, that sort of change feels a long way off because of how small the sort of plant-based food market is in the UK and how much meat we currently consume and the direction of travel of meat that we currently consume. But that sort of change can happen. It has happened in the past. You look at the way sort of the difference in the amount of chicken we eat between 1950 and the present day has been an extraordinary transition, which you never would have thought would have happened if you were sort of in the 1950s. So
do you think that's been a bad thing?
I don't know. That's difficult to say, isn't it? Because you don't know what the alternative sort of counterfactual scenario would look like. I think we ate far more red meat, and the transition between red meat. Yeah, we need to eat less, but it's understanding that transition has happened.
Disaster. Yeah.
I mean, I think there are lots of reasons. I completely agree. We eat far too much animal protein generally. But what I'm saying is that transition, a huge transition in the way we eat, can happen. Chicken was so successful because it was so delicious and so versatile and fitted so well into people's changing lifestyles and fitted with a lot of sort of health messaging over time about red meat and saturated fat consumption. So, you know, that sort of change can happen. It's very difficult to direct, though. We don't.
You mean, in effect, that's the template? It's the template for the sort of alt protein sector that Chris has been working with. They've got to try and do what, in effect, the chicken industry
I think gives you hope that sort of size and scale of transition is possible. I'm not quite sure. And analysing that way, the reasons for why that change happened is a good place to start as a template.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So Tara, you've been hearing some optimistic thoughts here now, and I guess implicit in your remarks earlier is you must be quite sceptical of the idea of alt protein or really anything else being held up as a panacea to these problems.
I'm very sceptical of panaceas, but it doesn't mean that I don't think alternative proteins are a really necessary part of a very multi-pronged approach that we need to take. So I'd kind of like to respond to your chicken point in a minute, but I kind of wanted to zoom out because there has been a lot of talk on alt proteins, and as I said, I think they play a role, but we need to just think more broadly about the direction of travel. You've talked a bit about sustainable healthy diets, and I think that's really important, and that means diversification of diets. So if we want one kind of quick fix solution, again, I think they're a bit cheap, you know, but pulses and legumes are really, really good in lots of different ways. They are they help create more diverse cropping systems, which is good for agriculture. They provide income for farmers, and they're a very nutrient-rich, including fibre-rich source of food in our diets, and they are compatible with the kind of dietary cultures of pretty much people around the world, from soy and tofu through to lentils and dal, through to rice and peas and whatever. So I do think they're really important. You know, they're not entirely without their problems, because, as I say, nothing is. But so if we're focusing on sustainable healthy diets, we also need to think about interventions that go way beyond the market. So here we're talking about, regulation of pricing incentives and disincentives. And I think we're also talking about things like public procurement, and we're talking about things like standards and expectations of the corporate sector as well. Mm-hmm. But we're also talking about the food environment that we live in. You've talked about ads on the tube, but most of the ads we see on the tube are for unhealthier and less sustainable foods. So there needs to be more stringent regulation of the food environment. But also, we need to remember that we eat what we eat because we produce what we produce, and there are people who are producing, and they can't be left behind in the process. We talk a lot about just transitions, and I mean, I think there are moral arguments for just transitions, that you need to take people with you, and you need to support them into more sustainable forms of farming, different forms of food and non-food production and land management. And there are, let's say, more kind of selfish reasons for transitions, which are to do with the fact that you will get a very, very, as we have seen, very strong kickback to moves to shift towards a less animal-intensive future. When it comes to the chicken issue, I'm with you on that. I think it's been incredibly disastrous. We've seen a very, very strong focus on ruminants, so cattle and sheep, because of their very high climate, greenhouse gas producing, because of the methane that they produce, and because they have used large areas of land. But poultry produce, I mean, there is the animal welfare crisis, which you are much better able to speak about than me, but they also produce a different set of environmental problems, from huge nitrogen surpluses to ammonia emissions to a reliance on grains and soy, which these are human edible foods that we could be eating directly. They have both direct and indirect effects on land use change. And because they are the sort of white meat that no religion can possibly object to, because, they're just chickens, it means that kind of everyone pounces on them, and everyone's eating more and more of them, and because they have a health, you can eat them with a sort of health glow, lean white meat, and you can also, deep fry them. So it's so adaptable that it's gone up and up and up and up, and the cost to welfare, and obviously the Wye Valley and all the environmental problems, don't get the attention they require.
So we forget about the environmental problems caused by the waste from factory farming operations, but also the land footprint of the whole thing, because so much feed has to be grown, protein-rich feed usually, for these animals.
Yeah.
And then the welfare footprint in terms of the terrible lives often that these animals are living in very, very tight confinement. But optimism.
Yes.
So, Chris, it might be good to have you in on this issue of the future for farmers, because it must come up all the time. Farmers often hate this alt protein stuff because they think this is a vision of the future in which they have no place. This is a product produced in factories, not on farms. or do you see as the future for farmers?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. It's a really interesting one because as we see the views of farmers portrayed, it's usually via, I suppose, statements from some agricultural union or another, which is purporting to represent farmers and on some level does, but much more often is representing basically big agricultural corporations. The NFU is a great example of this. Very much National Farmers Union in the UK is seen as, you know, the voice of farmers and have, I think they're the group that met most with politicians last year and are sort of taken at face value as that. But in fact, most of the members of the NFU, well, actually, I wouldn't say most of the members, but members of the NFU include large agricultural corporations, supermarkets. They're not transparent about their membership or how their kind of voting or decision-making works. And as a result of that, often they are basically representing interests of big agricultural companies, which are often directly opposed to interests of individual farmers. When we look at how this narrative is sort of operationalized, you're right to say that it's usually a case of the good, hardworking farmers, ruddy cheeks, Wellington boots, all the rest of it, are having a hard time, and this is very frequently portrayed as to do with veganism and or alternative proteins, right? We've got to ban cultivated meat in Italy now to protect the farmers and stuff like this. It's actually not the case at all. The number of agricultural jobs in the UK, for example, has indeed gone right down. We've lost about two-thirds of agricultural jobs in the UK since the 60s, and during that same time, our production of meat has almost doubled. So it's not that the farming jobs are going away because people are moving away from meat and eating less meat. That we're producing more meat than ever, but we're doing it with fewer farmers in the chain than ever. And again, that is exactly what you'd expect to see for a food system going towards industrialized systems, factory farms more becoming the norm, right? There are fewer farming jobs, and life is tough for independent farmers, but it's not because people are moving away from meat and going towards unproductive alternatives. It's largely because of the consolidation of farms into these factory farming systems, and that's been a trend in our food system for many years. And there are opportunities now for farmers in alternative proteins, not only producing, of course, pea protein. The UK is one of Europe's largest producers of pea protein, which is a key ingredient in a lot of alternative proteins. But also now looking at cultivated meat as well. There was an event just last week, I think, or a couple of weeks ago in the Netherlands, where they cut the ribbon of the first cultivated meat farm in the Netherlands, which is a working farm that still has livestock, but now is also going to be able to produce cultivated meat from animal cells in the same facility. And there are a lot of advantages to farmers for doing this. One is that it may take, I think it's about 3 years for beef cattle to be mature, age of slaughter. And so that is quite an investment and a time commitment from a business perspective for the farm. But to produce cultivated meat, that can be done in like a couple of weeks. So it's a much faster turnaround on the product. You can expect revenue much more quickly than if you're rearing animals. So we're going to see more and more opportunities for farmers to be involved in alternative protein production. But yeah, the main thing I would say is that to challenge this kind of narrative that farms are having a hard time and that somehow because of veganism or alternative proteins, it's almost entirely to do with factory farms, and that's what's giving us fewer farming jobs than we used to have.
So Tara, I mean, you feel like there must be some disagreement lurking with Chris, I suppose, around you were emphasizing in your answer legumes like pulses, beans, things like that, where I guess your vision there is relatively unprocessed stuff, just eat the beans. Versus a lot of these companies Chris is talking about, it's exactly about extracting the protein from the peas and the beans so that what is otherwise a relatively indigestible form in which to eat protein becomes this, you know, the ideal is becomes a more digestible, palatable form. Leads to that whole debate around, is the processing itself a problem? To what extent should we just be eating the beans as they come out of the ground?
I think this is a classic example of a kind of false binary. I think we do need to be throwing everything we can at the problem. You know, I think in an ideal world, and I think we should keep ideals in mind and not forget them. We should be moving towards a system where the production systems are less input intensive, the consumption patterns are less processed, but that we are quite a long way off from that. In the meantime, people are eating a lot of processed food anyway. They might as well be eating processed food that is not meat intensive. So that's where alternative proteins come in and some level of processing come in. You know, is there anyone in this room who does never eat processed food? It's like you can't live in the real world. So we are where we are, and this plays a role. I think there's also a lot of, I mean, the ultra processed food debate is really, really complex, and there's a lot of kind of false vilification of certain foods there, which I know Anthony would love to talk about. So I think we need to be doing this, but what I suppose I'm wary of is the idea that yet another techno fix is going to save the day, yeah, when we need to be focusing on systems. And, you know, Chris has talked about the fact that, yes, there are opportunities for working with farmers, and I think that's really important. We should be seeking to find as many opportunities, as well as to kind of decouple this farmer identification of what it is to be a farmer from food producing, to open up opportunities for land stewardship, biodiversity conservation as well. So I think there's lots and lots that we can be doing there, but we do need to take this systems perspective rather than saying, here's a kind of, oh, we eat burgers, now we can eat plant burgers and everything's fine, because it really isn't.
Mm. Anthony, Tara was alluding to your views on these issues. What are your views?
I said about sort of eating transition from animal protein to plant protein. I don't necessarily think that's entirely alt protein. I probably agree with Tara on that. It's about making people eat more plant protein, but beans and lentils, delicious as they are not always convenient and not always desired by people. So we need to think of other approaches. I think it's important to understand processing and understand what sort of processes stuff is going through, because you know, you can take some a crop, a pea or something like that, and like you can convert that into various different things by various different processes. You can concentrate the amount of protein, you can strip some of the starch out of it, but that process does have an impact environmentally. You know, actually, if you look at the sort of life cycle analysis of a pea protein isolate, very heavily hexane extracted and then dried with a huge amount of energy to dry it, and then you turn that into a burger, that has a completely different carbon impact to making something from a pea flour. It has more protein, it's perhaps a bit easier to turn into something like a burger. So, you know, it's important to understand that process, and I do a lot of work on sort of understanding gentler manufacturing processes with lower environmental impact, because they are incredibly important. It's very easy just to say, if you have some plants, it will be fine. But actually, you look at the sort of a total sort of carbon impact of some pea isolates. They're in a similar sort of area to sort of pork and chicken, beef's way up there. So you know, it's very important to understand that processing. But in terms of the argument about ultra processing, I think that's it's an interesting argument. I have views on it. I think, you know, the whole sort of categorization of ultra processing demonizes many perfectly sensible foods, and actually, you know, completely sort of absolves meat and dairy, which are considered unprocessed. And if you go to any sort of events where people are talking about ultra-processed foods, they don't talk about the protein transition, because it's kind of an awkward and difficult thing for them. And you know, I think that's quite telling. But it's also creating a world where it's difficult to come up with sort of effective solutions. I also feel that people, you know, if we just completely say, oh, the whole ultra-processed thing is rubbish, we're ignoring the fact that how many consumers are viewing the food system currently, and that's the language we have to kind of understand and navigate. So I look in my career for less processed solutions. You know, I believe that food will always be underpinned by farmers growing stuff in fields, if I'm honest. The most of the food that people eat, I think everything else will be around the edges. And actually, even a cultivated meat is going to have to be fed on something which is almost certainly going to have to be grown in fields. So there'll always be a role for farmers, but that role will shift, as it always has over the last sort of few centuries.
Wonderful. It'd be great at this point to take questions from the audience. So we've heard important points of similarity across the panel, you know, about the deep problems in our food system, the urgent need for quite profound reforms. It seems like everyone is in agreement about that. But then some really interesting differences in emphasis around the role of relatively processed products versus eating more pulses and beans straight out of the ground, and about the different visions of what the role for farmers is in the future of food. If, you know, if everyone is saying there's got to be some changes in what they're doing, there's often leads to the farming community feeling quite besieged, I suppose. Nonetheless, we're totally reliant on farming for food, and some interesting differences of perspective on that. So if you have a question, please put your hand up, and we'll also take some questions from online as well. What we'll do is we'll take three questions at once, just so that we get more questions in total. And let's start in the front row here.
Hello. In the food sector, if it's true that significant change is needed to meet environmental and public health targets or objectives, what is it, does the panel think, that it will take for meaningful legislation to impact, especially in relation to, say, transport or energy, where it's relatively draconian by comparison? I've heard about why it doesn't, Big Third Loser, for example, but what's the tipping point? What will it take?
Great, and let's take three. So there was another one from the front row there. Yeah.
Because farming is quite intensive, it's also an economy. So aren't we really talking about who's running the means of production here? And I'm curious as to why you're not talking about eating the consumption of insects, which is being also a possible source of animal protein that we can use, because you can grow them, billions of them, and you can do whatever you want with them and not care.
Great issue to raise. And then let's take a third one. Let's go further back if we can, so that we're not too front row biased. Yeah, let's take the third one from there.
Thank you for such a wide-ranging discussion. It's all fascinating. I'm particularly interested in if we're going to look after the planet better, if we're going to care for the planet better, what do we need to do between ourselves, between each other, and what do we need to do to be more honest with ourselves about consumption of animals being consumption of living beings, which we should surely be caring for better, and to better inform ourselves about the processes that are currently involved with the way that some people consume those. And if we're going to apply some psychology to that, whether that's shock tactics of showing people pictures of creatures being gassed or got rid of in other ways, or whether we're going to be subtler about that and say, for those people that still want to eat meat, there are perhaps better ways of doing it. What are we going to do to change our own psychology to save the planet, to care for it better, and care for the other living beings that are currently consumed and sadly exterminated?
Thanks. Yes, so some really interesting questions about legislation, about insects, and about human psychology. Who would like to come in on these?
I can talk a bit about insects if we want.
In terms of my
opinion, I mean, I think I've seen lots of interesting sort of work on insect protein. There's obviously some blackfly larvae, for instance, are very good at utilising food waste, and there are certain environments where it is, you know, sort of quite possible to farm various insect species, and actually sort of from a regulatory perspective, it is getting a bit easier to sell and use them. The issue that I have is I can't persuade people to eat beans. Do you know what I mean? I can't persuade people to eat more plant protein, which they have less sort of psychological and hang-ups about, or presumably not anyway. So it's a whole. In terms of in the UK, because in Europe, where I mostly work, in terms of developing food products, that's a challenge. So insects, I think, would be a further challenge. I think they're an important part, perhaps, of the eventual transition. I think there are barriers to consumers, and I can't get over these initial barriers about beans. So I'm struggling with insects. I think they have a place, and I think they're interesting, especially in terms of where they use food waste.
They're still very plausibly sentient beings that feel what's happening to them. I think, you know, people quite easily see this with bees, I think. Like, it's so easy to think of a lovely, charming bee as a sentient creature with feelings. Much harder when it's these black soldier fly larvae. Nonetheless, I think we have to take that possibility seriously and care about their welfare. You know, one of the problems with this industry so far, this emerging insect farming industry, has been very, very poor welfare standards.
Got a little bit to say about insects, and then I can zoom out and talk a little bit about the kind of legislation side of things. But I mean, the other thing is that some insect production systems need to be kept very, very warm. So there's quite they can be quite energy intensive. So they don't stack up to be as great as you might think. And I think the other thing to note is that, and it applies across the board, I think, with alternative proteins more generally, is are their effects additive or substitutional? So when I've seen some insect products in store, they tend to be those like kind of bars, you know, that kind of thing, which I don't know, people eat when they go to the gym or whatever it is that they do. They don't actually substitute for your dinner. And I think that is also something to consider more generally. When it comes to like the what will it take to get governments to, I think, govern is sort of what you're saying. It's kind of a really, really big question. We've had some moves towards better standards in school meals, so that's something that we're beginning to see. That restriction on advertising of junk food keeps being delayed. And then there's the introduction of the sugar tax to sweetened milk that's coming in. Who knows what's going to happen there? I mean, back in the beginning of this year, I think it was the Ministry of Defence published the UK National Security Assessment, which made clear the massive security problems arising from ecosystem collapse throughout the world. And it made lots of very scary points, but one of the points it made was that if the UK were forced into a position of self-sufficiency, we don't have enough land on current diets and with current production practices to actually feed ourselves. So you'd think that that would wake a few people up, but it doesn't. So I don't know, you know, if I was a very revered grandfather of this food system movement, Tim Lang, I would say, you know, we need a war. Well, we have lots of wars. I don't really know. I don't really know what the answer is.
Tim Lang wants to go to war.
No. What he has said is that some big shock to the system is what's going to,
You're not recommending war as a solution.
No,
I'm
declaring war. The
lever is Tim Lang, I'm sure.
He's definitely not.
You just mean politicians need to be forced to think about food security. It's an issue that gets pushed down the agenda, even though it's incredibly important.
Yeah. And on your kind of means of production thing, I mean, again, I'm not an economist, but I think one thing I would say is that unless we take inequality seriously, then most of our problems are just not going to get solved. And I think that operates at so many different levels that we need that, you know, people talk about food poverty, that there isn't food poverty, there's poverty. And one consequence of that poverty is inequalities in access to healthy, sustainable food. So,
yeah. Should we take some questions from the online audience if we can? So Heidi Zamzo, who organized this event, did fantastic work putting the panel together, is also in charge of our online audience. Do we have any online questions?
We have a bunch of online questions.
Do you want to give us three of them?
It's hard to choose, but I'm going to go with these three. This one's a bit broad. So this is from Kenneth Pollock. It says, I hear more about blue foods these days. What role could food from the oceans play in this transition, whether this is, you know, live fish, farmed fish, or, you know, seaweeds, other, you know, ocean plants. Then we have one from Kevin in San Francisco, which I'd never thought of. Another of the biggest sectors of greenhouse gas emissions is the transportation sector. What is the interplay between the food and transportation sectors with respect to sustainability? And what opportunities do changes to our food system have for co-benefits in other sectors. And lastly, for the psychologists on the stage, do alternative proteins reinforce meat symbolism and the idea that animals should remain in the category of the edible?
Wonderful, yeah. So three fascinating questions again. Who would like to come in on any of those?
Yeah, I'll say a few things on that. So firstly, on the transportation thing, I think the main thing that I think about that is that food miles is a sort of bit of food sustainability language that everyone kind of has on the hard drive, and a concept that is sort of quite intuitive. If you're eating local foods, presumably that's better for the environment. In fact, when talking about the environmental impact of foods, the vast majority of it occurs before it leaves the farm gate, as they say. So this might seem counterintuitive to people, but you really are better off eating imported, ultra-processed Beyond burgers than you are from eating local beef burgers. Again, that might seem counterintuitive, that might seem like it's not the case, but it certainly is. Like, also not even close, by the way. It's orders of magnitude more environmentally efficient, lower emissions, energy use, water use, et cetera, et cetera. There's another point that I'd make on this thing about more processed plant foods versus beans and legumes. The more processed plant, there may be some difference between them in terms of healthiness or environmental outcomes, but the more processed plant foods are like 90% better than the animal foods. And so when you come to argue about the two versions of the plant-based things, you're really, you know, scrapping over that remaining 10%. Almost all of it is in getting away from the animal products. And that goes too for food miles also. I think you are better off eating imported plant-based foods than local animal foods from an environmental perspective. I'll say very briefly on the blue foods. I'm interested to see what Professor Birch has to say about this. I think that from a moral perspective, consuming wild caught fish is a very, very different proposition from consuming farmed animals, where it's kind of clearer that this is a utility drain. We're breeding these animals and now we're going to farm them on factory farms and then we're going to slaughter them. For wild caught fish, there are all sorts of other issues with overfishing and environmental consequences and so on. But strictly from a moral perspective, they are out there being wild fish, doing that, encountering whatever suffering they're doing, consuming other fish in many cases, which we might also care about. So it's not quite as clear to me that that represents a utility loss when we're talking about consuming wild fish, but I'll be very interested to see what your take on that.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably true that the fish in the wild have better lives right up until the point they're dragged out of the water, and then it gets very bad very quickly.
Quite.
But you're right to raise the welfare issues posed by some forms of aquaculture. In our group, we look a lot at salmon farming and at shrimp farming, where you're talking about that close confinement thing again that has been so terrible with the chickens and the pigs. We're now packing absolutely enormous numbers of salmon or shrimps into very small spaces with high potential to lead to very clear welfare problems, very poor quality of life for those animals. And so I'm always there saying, you know, remember about them even when it's a shrimp. They're much smaller, which means people will sit down and eat 25 of them in a single sitting. But they were individual animals who often had really terrible lives. So, for that reason, I end up being quite skeptical of solutions to climate problems that in the process cause new kinds of animal suffering. The animal suffering always looms quite large, for me, as it would, running a centre for animal sentience.
Yeah. I appreciated your point as well about the insects along that same line, so like the small body problem where the smaller they are, the more of them you need
That's
to produce
right,
the same
yeah.
amount of food, and so potentially the worse outcome. And I'll say very, very quickly on the meat symbolism thing, and I know other people want to come in on these questions also. For me, I'm very, very pragmatic about thinking about this kind of thing. I've heard this kind of concern expressed that, oh, if you have plant-based burgers, it's sort of continuing to fetishize the idea of meat, or like reinforce the idea that it's okay to eat animals or something like that. I'll just say, for me, it's the moral difference is the same as the moral difference between me going home and playing Grand Theft Auto video game versus me going out and actually slaughtering civilians, right? This is the moral difference between like a meat simulation versus meat, in my view. So, yeah.
Ben?
So, yeah, maybe I can comment on the last question because I'm the psychologist here. So, well, I actually had this meeting with the Animal Think Tank, which is an organization also doing research on like the consumers of alternative protein. And one of their interesting findings is that the actual consumers, the majority, they have done the consumer segmentation analysis. So the largest consumer group of alternative protein is not the group that actually want the meat taste. So they are probably supporting the industry for the cause of the animal welfare or the sustainability angle. So we are actually hesitant about like the marketing strategy that the current sector is taking. So maybe it's also possible that we don't emphasize it's a meat replacement, because a lot of times when you emphasize it's a meat replacement, then when people taste it, it doesn't taste exactly like meat. People get disappointed and don't get back. So it's possible to actually frame it as a new category or maybe a novel food. Like I heard about Japanese companies thinking about like framing it as a sci-fi kind of future food, like future. So we can think about alternative ways to how to frame it away from the meat narrative, of course. And but it's also but I kind of think that emphasizing the protein side might be efficient in some cases, because in my country, so I'm from China, there is actually health analysis of the plant-based and the vegetarian and the meat eating groups, and in the senior population, so the health condition of the vegetarians are actually worse than that of the meat eating population, because our traditional way of eating plant-based food is not really healthy. It's low, very low in protein. So maybe there's always this balance. You kind of need to persuade people into eating the plant-based diet in a more healthy way. So you promote it more properly. And it's also the public image kind of thing. So if you have your grandma who is vegetarian but she doesn't look very healthy, it will have a higher psychological impact on you than a paper saying that it's meat consumption or overconsumption of red meat associated with cancer risk or heart diseases. So I think it's definitely possible that we move away from alternative protein as meat replacement, but it's probably important to emphasize the protein, the health benefits of it as competent as meat.
So I'm afraid that's all we have time for. I feel like we've been grappling with some absolutely enormous problems and we've not been able to solve them in a single hour. But I do draw some consolation from Tara's thought that it's comforting to think lots of people are working on these problems from many different disciplines, working on trying to find visions of the future of food that can address some of the difficulties our current systems face. So thanks very much, everyone, for your questions. Thanks to Heidi Zamzo again for organizing, and thanks so much to all four of our panelists.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.